This is Canopy Conversations, where we take you behind the scenes at Canopy and share insights from the team. I'm your host, Eric Schwartz. Today's episode, we're featuring Jeff Reitman, one of our GPs, head of our New York office, and all around fantastic human being. Thanks, Jeff, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Well, appreciate it. And frankly, you didn't have a choice. We conscripted you to this episode. So appreciate you actually logging in. I love a good origin story. And you've got a little bit of a different one from your typical venture guy. So you went to Yale about two decades ago, graduated. And for 3 years, you were the co-founder and CTO of GX Studios, media entertainment company creating web-based games. So first question, a softball, and one that inquiring minds want to know, are you a gamer? And if so, what's your favorite game?
So the surprising answer here is not really when it comes to video games, which was actually a pretty big lesson when starting a company to do something you're intensely passionate about. But I always was deeply into puzzles. And then that bled into strategy and strategic games. So big fan of Risk and chess and Monopoly and overall winning. And so had passion for that. Obviously got to grow up in a pretty unique time for gaming. You could skip the Atari era, but after that, I had pretty much it all. Nintendo first generation, Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis, like the full workup all the way to Xbox and, where we are today. So had a lot of fun doing that as a kid. Had a unique opportunity to start a gaming company with some friends, really targeted at the college demographic and just ran with it. Was really passionate about, starting something and trying to make something big.
So you talked about the whole notion around building something that you're super passionate about. What other lessons did you take away from that experience and specifically around how you approach investing today?
Sure. First, it's kind of important just to set context on what happened, right? So we started the business in 2007 when it was actually still amazing to raise money and then ran the business during the financial crisis. And as a 21, 22-year-old kid who had no financial services background whatsoever, I had no context what was going on in the broader markets other than it seemed like a bloodbath. And so, back then we raised a seed round of $375,000, which seems like less than a lot of pre-seed rounds going today. So it was just an exercise of stretching that for as long as you possibly could, being on a shoestring budget. And it really had me appreciate just like how to get more with less, which is something that we need all of our founders to be doing in this market. Yeah. Ultimately, it became our organic growth channels dried up and it became really hard to scale the business. We needed more capital. I pitched every investor you could think of on Sand Hill Road. They thought we were the coolest thing since Facebook, but really digging into the business, we just didn't have as much business acumen and as much market fit as we needed to raise that capital. And so, I learned a lot through that. It feels great to be wanted to be pitched and all that stuff, but there's a lot of ways to say no. There's only one way to say yes, and that's with a check. Right. There's a lot of investors that string you along that aren't really upfront with you about step-by-step process to get to a yes. And as an entrepreneur, you're already nervous. You've made a lot of commitments to other people to come join you on your mission. And so, it's hard to realize that as an investor, but I created a lot of empathy on this side of the table by being on that side of the table, which I think actually does help a lot in my engagement with entrepreneurs. So, we ultimately sold that business to a digital media company. I got some of my money back for investors, but I actually lost money for people as an entrepreneur. And what was amazing is that some of those people wrote my recommendation to business school. Like some of those people would still back me again. And it also colored me in terms of just like playing the long game and being patient with folks, because not every time is going to be the successful time. So there's a lot more there, a lot of scar tissue that I hope to not revisit for a long time. But that's some of the key things that I got to uncover being on the other side.
Yeah, Jeff, I've known you for almost 3 years now. We never really talked about this. And it's funny when you describe your experience and I see how you show up with our founders, how you show up with our pipeline companies. I completely see how the experience and the challenges you had as a founder come through and the empathy that you bring to, really understanding the lonely journey that being a founder is, the challenges, the stress, the maniacal focus on building your business takes on you. It's fantastic. And I think one of the reasons why lots of models for successful venture partners and the one with that founder plus the financial services background, I think really comes through with you.
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. Hopefully we can keep that running for a long time. Hopefully that'll translate into a good return for us.
Absolutely. So, you know, I alluded to some financial services experience. Let's fast forward a little bit, go to business school at Wharton, become an investment banker at JP Morgan, kind of following that more traditional post-graduation approach, making up for your time as a founder coming out of undergrad. You've been at Canopy since the beginning and spent time at another VC, and you've led our deals in some of our most exciting Fund One and Fund Two companies, Nova Credit, Kodak, Capitalize, Peach, Theropass, just to name a few. We're now, you know, 20-ish% deployed in Fund Two. Let's talk a little bit about lessons from the past 4 years and how they're influencing your strategy and approach to deploying capital at some of the earlier stage companies in Fund Two.
Sure. I mean, first, you know, just to even go back further than that, like, you know, I joined, Canopy early, but when I got here, you know, Chip and Gene and Walker and Neil had done a lot to get the shape of Canopy. And so I got to step into a fortunate position where we had a bunch of capital commitments from our bank LPs. And it was really about trying to figure out, you know, how did we want to craft the firm? And I was able to, draw from a lot of lessons learned in helping to start NYCA before Canopy. And to those guys' credit, they were really open to doing that alongside with me. Like, and that's what made the partnership early days so great. And I think that's what still makes the partnership great today. You know, the last 4 years have been some of the most exciting and tumultuous 4 years that I experienced in the last 10 years of doing this. I would never have predicted COVID, never would have predicted the run-up after COVID or the bubble kind of bursting post the run-up. And I think like one of the general lessons, which I always sort of knew, but I really believe now, is you just can't predict the future in this business. And I think our job as capital deployers is to try to see who has a good chance of creating the future, but we can't predict it. And trying to is kind of a fool's errand because, like I said, who would have predicted COVID in 2020? That would have been a pretty hard thing to do. And so I think about that a lot. And some of that informs like pacing, like putting out some capital every year, because this might be the best year ever to put it out. And it may not feel that way until in 2 years from now when it's a lot worse. Right. Trying to get a part of every vintage. So that's a key learning. When I first joined, I had this real serious conviction around concentration that mm-hmm. I always felt like the most limited resource in venture capital was not capital, it was time. And even after the last 5 years at Canopy, I still have as much conviction in that philosophy as I did 5 years ago. I think one of the things we've done really well that I hope we continue to do well is just really be heavily convicted in the companies that we back, own a lot of those companies. I think being in the boardroom puts you at like the tip of the spear from an information perspective. And I think that allows you to just sharpen your toolkit as an investor very, very quickly. And this is a very long feedback loop job. And so it's really hard to iterate in this business. And so being in the information flow is like the best way you can do it. And so I think we've been able to do that. I mean, every one of the GPs is on boards of our companies. We're super involved in that information. We share information across the firm really efficiently. And I think these are all building blocks to building like a world-class investment firm, which I know is what we're all trying to do. And that information gets to benefit all of our LPs, which is even more of a special thing and really what the model is built on. And so I didn't have that, you know, all the time when I was at NYCA. We weren't leading deals. We weren't in the boardroom. And I'm really happy that we do that here. And I think that those are pretty good things to take with us. And on the flip side, the only thing I would say is, look, the market in 2020 and 2021 were really good markets to sell. And like we had just gotten started, so we weren't really in a position to do that. But it really, really colored me today on when you have the opportunity to take chips off the table in a market that feels irrational in your favor, do it. Don't let your eyes get too big. And I think I was definitely susceptible to the big eye syndrome of 21, thinking about how big things can get. I think it was Gene or Chip that once said, like, trees don't grow to the sky, Jeff. And, you know, I think about that a lot now in terms of just lessons learned over the last few years.
Admittedly, we're going to go off script for just a second, but when you were talking about Sand Hill Road earlier, you think that's really the nexus of venture. Then you were talking about information flow, and I'm thinking about the role that New York is playing in venture and specifically in fintech. Now you lead our New York office, know the ecosystem in the New York area. Can you talk a little bit about how tech has evolved in New York City and specifically around like the importance of fintech to that ecosystem?
So I love this question. So in 2008, I'm running my startup and we moved the company from New Haven, which is where we went to school, to New York. And at the time, WeWork did not even really exist. We ended up renting space in Astor Place at a place called Sunshine Suites, where they had three floors in a building. And each floor was a different theme of like meditation type theme with like foresty stuff. Yeah. And the one thing that WeWork ended up getting right that these guys messed up was they had floor to ceiling at WeWork windows that blocked out the sound and created privacy. This did not. We were just in a cubicle farm, just trying to run a business. And ironically, like I was sitting next to a stockbroker in 2008 who was freaking out trying to predict like where the Dow would fall to.
Right.
And being in that environment, we realized how like alone in New York we actually were. We were a bunch of young guys trying to create a technology startup, and there weren't even enough people like us in the same workspace. And that was the only workspace that existed at the time. So we tried to get around that by creating meetups. And we created a New York gaming meetup. And I remember like only probably 30 people joined that. And like, that was the community. That was it. Like there wasn't even that many concepts of meetups back then. And it just like is a great reminder of how nascent the environment was. And so when I re-entered the ecosystem in 2014, like fintech was now starting to become a buzz term. It wasn't like universally accepted like it is today, but it was starting. Stripe was really breaking out. There were things to look at, you know, LendingClub had IPOing a couple of months later. Mm-hmm. There were things to look at in terms of success. And the venture community was just starting to bud. And, you know, I fast forward, you know, 10 years later, and now New York is really the hub of fintech. I think we have a bigger presence in New York than we do in San Francisco as an industry. Sequoia, Index, Lightspeed, Bessemer, they all have offices in New York City. Bain, they're all between Union Square, Flatiron, Soho, you know, kind of general areas. When we signed our lease in Soho, I think we were, you know, one of the only venture funds down here besides we're Thrive and GC. Now I know like 10 other funds that have moved just in the last year and a half. So the ecosystem is as active and vibrant as I've ever seen it. It makes me really excited. I bump into entrepreneurs and other VCs on the street. That's a really, really cool thing. And I think the recycling of talent and knowledge is how we're going to build really good continued businesses here. And I think being in market just really helps us see stuff. But I also appreciate how we're a national brand and how we look between the coast and in smaller cities, and especially where many of our LPs have great footprints. And so I think the mix between the two is what makes Canopy special, but I'm very, very bullish on New York.
So let's talk strategy a little bit more. When we had our LP summit a few months ago, we talked about the fact that whereas in Fund One, we were really focused on Series A, Series B, in Fund Two, we're starting to explore more of a seed strategy. And so playing in an area where we, let's say, experimented in a little bit in Fund One, but certainly didn't focus on. And Fund Two, looking at even some newly or soon to be announced deals, fall into that seed category. So can you talk a little bit about why we're exploring seed and where you see that opportunity leading?
Yeah, I like to set this context here just through the lens of Fund One, which is in Fund One, like you said, you know, we really employed a venture and venture style growth strategy. And the growth deals we did, we tried to build, you know, pick the best player in the category that we thought would be the category winner. We tried to pick things that could experience some capital loss on the downside, but also could also have a 5 to 10x return on the upside because they were massive markets, massive visions, really, really strong founders. You know, in the last 2 years, a lot of the air in the fintech and software ecosystem has come out of the bubble. And venture growth as an asset class is not really vibrant today. There's not a lot of opportunities that kind of existed in the way that we thought. And a lot of that's just driven by the fact that the IPO ecosystem is not what it was. You know, you can get out, but you have to be perfect. M&A is clearly down by historical standards, especially multiples have come down and whatnot. So, you know, we think there's a lot of value to doing some traditional growth mixed in with the venture growth now. You know, I'm super excited that we hired Tom on the West Coast to really help us build out that strategy. And in that case, some of those businesses will just have more limited downside in when it doesn't work, and maybe more limited upside when it does. But there's real, you know, really interesting opportunities that could really help our bank LPs in that cohort. And so in order to build a best-in-class venture strategy, we need to create balance with that. And that probably involves having more like 20 core venture bets versus 10 to 15. And the easiest way to do that is by investing in seed. And seed kind of gives us an opportunity to get into these businesses at lower valuations. And it gives more time before they get to the later stage rounds for the market to just generally recover. And so I'm very bullish about the returns we could make on some of these investments if we get into the right ones.
And I guess similarly, we've talked about this in the past, but the opportunity for LPs when engaging with earlier stage companies, financial returns aside, there's an opportunity to help shape product market fit, and you provide direct feedback to the company as they evolve their own product set, which I know a number of our LPs have gotten involved with in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're spending time with an enterprise model risk management workflow company. I never thought I would wake up and say that I'm spending time with a company that does that. And, you know, we've already approached some of our LP banks to consider being a design partner. And like, what's better than solving a really core regulatory problem than, you know, signing up really early to shape the product and possibly get, you know, a custom product that you kind of meets your needs at a lower cost than once we kind of find real product market fit and start scaling. And so that has been really fruitful. I'm looking forward to hopefully working with that company in the coming months more in a more serious capacity. But that's just one of many examples where we could really set the stage and have allow banks to really shape the direction of where these companies go.
So expanding the conversation from kind of where are we investing in terms of the funding status of the companies and focusing more on some of the thematic trends that you're seeing where you're spending time. What's getting you excited now? You talked about model risk management as one. It probably wasn't on your bingo card, much like COVID and the financial crisis, but anything else that comes to mind is like new trends, new technologies that you're excited about from an investment point of view, and then maybe things that our banks can take advantage of?
Yeah, so I've been spending time with Harry on our team, really trying to figure out, you know, what's going to be relevant over the next several years. And one of the things that starting points that we created for ourselves is, okay, like what happens in this higher interest rate environment? And our view on that is higher interest rates are going to create NIM compression for a lot of banks. That's going to hit certain levels of profitability, and it's going to impact level of investment on the tech side. But to counterbalance that, we think banks are going to start looking for other ways to generate income that doesn't require balance sheet and isn't as interest rate sensitive. And so things that are fee income based is a really good way to approach that. And so two of the most common business types that generate fee income are payments and wealth. And, you know, we're trying to spend a lot of time in both of those categories. We've put out a few thought pieces on wealth, and real credit to Harry for the amazing work that he's been doing there. But we're digging in on all facets and thinking through things like tax, things like estate planning, and complex tax structuring for multi-generational pieces, thinking through, you know, how do people sell businesses and transfer wealth, advisor tooling. We just made an investment in the space, an early stage company that helps advisors source leads. And so we're just trying to get really deep to think about what is the tech stack of the future. And I think we're really excited for all of the innovation that's coming down the pike in that category. And then, on the payment side, same thing. I think we can be doing more there, and we want to be. I think we all believe payments will become faster, not slower in the future, less friction, not more friction. And we're doing a lot to try to help, be part of that journey from the Canopy perspective.
Yeah, so kind of continuing to build on this, we talked thematics, we talked investment stage. When you think about the funnel that comes in, whether we're generating leads, founders are meeting us because of the thought leadership that we're putting out, how do you, or what factors do you consider when you're deciding what companies are worth leaning into? Are there any kind of general rules of thumb that you're using when trying to narrow that funnel down?
Yeah, look, I am extremely founder-driven with respect to the lens that I view investing. I put that significantly above thematic categories. I put it above even markets and TAM. And part of it is just these are the people you are partnering with for the next 10 years in a situation you cannot fully control. And you better be excited to wake up every day to help them build a really big business, because life is kind of short. And if you're not waking up excited about that, chances are the people they hire will not be either. Investors that look at their business will not be either. And so the best founders tend to put human capital and capital to work to create value for the future. And I try to identify who those founders should be, are. And over time, what I look at in doing that has evolved, because I've learned that what leads tends to lead to founders that do what they say they're going to do and follow up and are able to ship product, and ones that kind of do a lot of talking and not a lot of shipping, which I try to avoid. And so I think it's super important as an investor to not be the smartest person in the room that you enter often. Looking at why there's clear founder market fit, founder product fit, why do they have a reason to be in the market? Why is now the right time? But I think it all comes back to the team and founder, and sets of founders, because that you can't easily change. You could pivot the business, you could create a new product. You cannot really just swap out the team at the earliest of stages. So that's like a major piece. And then look, we got to run a good business. You got to have good unit economics, a good sense of what actually are the levers or the key KPIs in the business. And with respect to that, I kind of believe that if I could help sell something, I'm often excited to buy it. And so I will often work with founders to create introductions to our fintech alliance, to other people in the market, to really see, is there a long-term buyer there? And sometimes it doesn't always sound like, yes, I'm ready to buy. But sometimes you're just looking for that little opening where someone might change their mind 1 or 2 years in the future because assumptions they had might be a little different than what they are at that time. And that's where value is created, like around behavioral change. And so, yeah, we do a lot of work around market fit and TAM and things like that. But really, the most important thing to me are the people, and whether I feel inspired to work with them, and whether others will be as well.
Well, and I think, in reflecting one on the companies and founders you've backed, but even just the way you show up at Canopy, that comes through time and time again. We are in a relationship business, and you're masterful at developing, maintaining these relationships. And I think it's a benefit to all of us, both on the investing side here at Canopy and certainly our LPs.
Well, I got to do this more, Eric, because you keep flattering me. So it's a good way to get me back on the pod.
We'll wrap up with just one other question, moving away from investing and more on you. We could go in a lot of directions with getting to know you personally. I think you hold the record of most amount of fantasy leagues won here at Canopy, at three or four at this point. But one thing that we haven't touched on is the fact you're a big traveler. You've got two little ones now, so I imagine traveling's a little bit harder than it used to be, at least getting kids on the planes and things like that. But if you think about favorite place you've traveled thus far and place that's on the, top one or two list, but you haven't yet gotten, what would those be?
Yeah, so We did just have my son, our second, in April of this year. And so not getting that much sleep still, definitely not planning any getaways with Ashley anytime soon. But on the list of favorites, I actually proposed to Ashley in Santorini in Greece. And the reason why I picked Santorini, other than the amazing views and like the amazing sunsets, is because I knew I wanted to do a destination proposal, but I only wanted to do it in a place I had already been to because I didn't want any surprises because I knew I was going to be a nervous wreck.
Right.
And so it just so happens that on the first international trip I brought my wife on when we first started dating was to Portugal and Greece, and we stopped by Mykonos and Santorini. And I just think back on that time, and then obviously the proposal time, as like some of the most magical times of my entire life. And it just like the way people show up there, the amount of relaxation one can have there, the consistency of the weather, the beauty, all of it is amazing. We rented an ATV in Mykonos and went around the island. And I just think that's like the funnest idea ever. And, you know, just renting a car in Santorini and going to visit some of the beaches and going to a vineyard and all those things. Like that's definitely my speed, of vacation. So I look forward to getting back there. I don't know if it'll be for a 10 year or 15 year or 20 year or what, but I look forward to getting back over there and trying to recreate the fun of my 20s. And then in terms of where I haven't been, I mean, as much as I traveled in business school and a few of the years after, there's so much of the world that I've not covered. So Argentina comes to mind, like would love to go and explore Argentina, Africa. You know, I've never been to any parts of Africa, would love to go to South Africa, do some type of safari at some point. Korea, I had a roommate in college from Korea. I never had the opportunity to go visit him, but it just sounds like one of the coolest cultures. And I would love to go kind of explore that, you know, from, you know, at some point. But I think, unfortunately, my days of traveling are going to be limited until I become an empty nester at some point. And so I'm going to try and get a little by little in now, and then really go, maybe hopefully go crazy when we free up from time and responsibility. And
got a long way to go, my friend.
Yep. Yep. Where the clock just started or restarted, I should say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look forward to you getting on the road more. Look forward more to you staying in the office and finding incredible deals and founders and companies for us to invest in and partner with. Jeff, thanks for taking the time to get together this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Canopy Conversations is confidential and may not be relied upon as investment, legal, or tax advice. Please carefully review Canopy Connect terms and conditions for further information.